Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Aha, feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. Nikias, holla if you hear me. It's time to hoop it up.
It is indeed finally time to hoop it up as we record on a Thursday morning, which means we are not getting the super early game on the W slate as W Action returns today. W Action that counts in the standings, rather, returns today. We're not getting the second round of the NBA draft. I'm sure we will have some second round reaction on the next episode of the pod. So early disclaimer there. Buddy, this has been a very fun morning, as Steve expertly alluded to in the intro, but we are here to hoop it up. Lots of things have happened since the last time we recorded. We got some trades, we got some extensions, we got some signing intentions announced, since signings can't officially be announced yet. We got the first round of the draft, some interesting picks, some draft day trades, we got some W news. We got a lot to talk about in this episode, so we're going to dig right in. We will start on the NBA front, and we will start with some trades. The New York Knicks and the Brooklyn Nets agreeing to a deal. The first time the two teams have agreed to a trade since 1983, which is a fun piece of trivia. But the Knicks now have Mikal Bridges, along with 87% of like Villanova alumni at this point. It's a very interesting deal. But either way, the Knicks received Mikal Bridges in a 2025 second round pick. The Nets getting Bojan Bogdanović for unprotected first in 2025, 2027, 2029, and 2031, a 2028 first round pick swap, and a 2025 second. Steve, where do you start with this one?
Well, honestly, you want my first thought when this happened?
Yes.
So Bogey did all that just to be a net again? That was my first thought. But Bridges to the Knicks, obviously a lot of noise about him wanting to be there. We know the Villanova connection, but boy, that is a whole lot of defense for that team. Mm-hmm. And I think the fit there makes a lot of sense considering what he can do defensively. Offensively, we saw how he grew in Phoenix, went to Brooklyn, saw another level of growth. Last season probably wasn't what either side expected as far as the offense went. But in this New York Knicks system, having the ability to add movement, to be used as a screener, to space the floor, I think that really helps the Knicks. The defense, if you're able to have Bridges, Josh Hart, OG, or Dante out there at all times, that's really tough to deal with. So mm-hmm. It felt very specific to, hey, Boston, what's up? We're here. I know the pick cost looks like a lot, and I always try to balance it sometimes when it comes to like the amount of draft capital that teams are willing to give up, because I think it more signifies that they really want that player as opposed to anything else. And so I think the Knicks had set themselves up to make a move, but with this new CBA and the second apron and the mystery around it, how long could they afford to wait? Especially with this being kind of like a, I don't want to say a win now window, but they're going for it clearly. And so I think being able to add that caliber of a player really, really says a lot about where they're trying to go. And I think he fits what they want to do on both ends of the floor.
Mm-hmm. Like, this one caught me off guard just because there's been so much reporting around the Nets just saying no a bunch to Mikal Bridges, to Mikal Bridges trades in particular. I think going back to last year when we got the rumblings that I want to say the Memphis Grizzlies like offered four firsts. And again, it's not just four firsts. It's, hey, is this a first from a really good team? Is this a highly protected first? Like, obviously more goes into that. But point of the matter is the Nets have not been super willing to move Mikal Bridges and kind of cash in on the chip, try to accelerate the rebuild, et cetera. So for them to go about face on this caught me off guard. But as you talk about the fit, I'm just really excited for Mikal Bridges. Like, it's easy to make the Villanova / podcast jokes on that front. But just with Mikal as a basketball player, him being in a spot to where you can really unlock the off-ball stuff with him again, I think is really cool. Now, you can quibble if, you know, if Jalen Brunson is the best player he's played with. Like, he's got to play with Chris Paul before decline really set in. He's got to play with Devin Booker, et cetera. This does feel like the first time in his career where he's gotten to play with two players that can draw two as a scorer. in what Julius Randle brings as a post-up threat slash driver. Jalen Brunson routinely blitzed last year, particularly when Randle went down. And so now getting to bring back the cutting from Mikal Bridges and him getting more catch and shoot opportunities from three, not him not having to carry as much of an offensive burden. I think he is going to enjoy that and enjoy the freedom that comes with that. He's certainly going to accentuate what the Knicks do offensively because of his ability to play off ball and to puncture defenses that are already tilted. Defensively, as it is fair to acknowledge that there was a slide from Mikal Bridges last year defensively with all the on-ball responsibility that he had on the offensive side of the ball, switched more often than he ever has. That's kind of built into Brooklyn's ethos. But some of those switches were, ooh, I'm hit on the screen. I can't recover. Hey, you pick this up. And that felt uncharacteristic for what we've come to expect from Mikal Bridges defensively. He might just be defending number twos now, which is a nice change if OG Anunoby's getting that top defensive assignment. You still have Dante DiVincenzo on the roster. You still have Josh Hart on the roster. We've made jokes about how willing Tom Thibodeau is to go small, particularly with Randle at the five. But at the very least, he has options with some of these lineups. And I think if you zoom out with the Knicks, they should feel better about what happens when Jalen Brunson goes to the bench with this roster. And obviously, there's an offseason to go. We have OG news that we'll get to a little bit later. We will see what happens on the Isaiah Hartenstein front. But you can feel better about both ends of the floor when Brunson hits the bench, if you're able to stagger and still have like Mikal and or Julius Randle on the floor for you. So this just feels like a really good swing for the New York Knicks. I understand why the price appears steep. That is a lot of picks, especially once you, if you want to go back to last year to where they could have been, or the year before last, where they could have been a Donovan Mitchell team and ultimately decided we're not giving up all of this for Donovan Mitchell. But for them to cash in now, get this kind of talent, who's still making reasonable money now. I think he's extension eligible, if not this offseason, the next offseason, but still young, can play on both ends of the floor. I just love the fit and I love what the Knicks are building. And if you're the Nets, you get Boyan back for now, at the very least. We'll see if he ends up getting traded again this offseason. But to start to get control of some draft picks, to kind of replenish the chest on that regard, I think it's a smart bit of business. Especially considering where the rest of the East is right now. I have deeper thoughts on the Nets, but I did just want to cap it there.
Oh, well, if you want to go more thoughts on the Nets, we can. Because once again, I wrote this very rapid thoughts once the trade went down. I wrote how many picks? How do the Nets keep getting all these picks? How do they get the picks back every time? Mm-hmm. And obviously there's another deal, which makes more sense as to what Brooklyn is trying to do. It's interesting because I know we talked about Chicago and the window as far as do we go now or do we go later. Mm-hmm. Brooklyn, for all the ups and downs, and shout out to Zach Lowe for summarizing my 2 years in Brooklyn as got very bad. It's cool. It's fine. I understand. But they always find a way to kind of pivot into the next direction. And so if Bridges isn't going to be that person, okay, we need to restart and move towards something else. And that's going to be the interesting part, to where can we now acquire more talent? What can we find? What's our next pivot point? We got draft capital. We do it again. And that's not an easy thing to do, especially in today's NBA.
That's true. Like, as you mentioned, like being able to pivot as quickly as they have been to either tear it down or, hey, here are these stars. Let's go get them. Like, it's not easy to be able to pull that off multiple times within, a decade? Not easy thing to do. But as we are right now, they have pivoted once again. They're able to get these four picks plus a swap and a second, if you care, depending on how much you care about that, in this trade. And then, as Steve already alluded to, with a different trade, them and the Houston Rockets talking. The Nets now have control of their 25 first again. They now have their 26 first round pick back. And so, depending on where, the Cooper Flagg class is, I believe he's draft eligible in 25. You are now able to reset this season in hopes of landing that pick and really jump starting your rebuild. And this is while the Nets still have lots of vets that teams like on their roster. Like, you still have a Dorian. You still have a Royce. You don't have a Royce. You still have a Dorian. So, you can add to the pick capital. Or if you don't want to add picks, okay, here's a contender that may have a young guy that isn't getting playing time right now, but we like. Here's this vet that helps you win now. We get another swing. And we can continue to take these young swings while we are resetting. And so, again, like, there is criticism to be had to how the Nets ended up back in this spot. But ultimately, they are doing the right thing by pressing the button and starting their reset now. I'm curious to see what this looks like. I've seen the Cam Thomas jokes on the timeline. He's about to take X amount of shots, whatever. I do think it's cool that he's getting even more of a runway. Like, all easy jokes to be made aside, we did see legitimate growth from him, both as a scorer on the interior, as a passer on the interior. And now him have not, you know, he doesn't have to step on toes at this point. Like, this is his offense. Let's see how much growth he showcases. And because he's as young as he is, if you are able to land insert prospect here next year, over the next 2 years, if you are able to establish assets, like, he's young enough to be an important part of whatever your next build is, or whatever your next version of good is. So this also just felt timely on that front. If you are going to give Cam a real runway, let's go ahead and do that. So understand why the Nets did what they did. The Knicks, again, paid a steep price, but Mikal Bridges is really good at basketball. And again, him being more to, you know, closer to three on the hierarchy offensively, I think fits what his skill set is. I think you see the defense return to form, especially since he has other good defenders around him on top of that. I'm really excited to see what this Knicks team is going to look like. Where would you, we obviously have an entire offseason to go, but I guess heading into like the free agency period over the weekend and stuff, are the Knicks number two for you in the East?
Are the Knicks number two for me in the East? I would hesitate to say number two. They're up there. Mm-hmm. They'd probably be in my top tier. I think the interesting part about them is very clearly in my head, it goes to, hey, we're ready for you, Boston. But also in my head, it goes to, and this happens across the league, where you kind of build your team to counter a certain team and then you face someone else. Mm-hmm. So who is that someone else that could poke at what the Knicks have? You know, is it Philadelphia? Is it Milwaukee? Is it Miami? Is it some version of an upgraded Orlando? So I would kind of hesitate right off the rip to go there. But they absolutely are in that top tier based on what they have, and we'll see what they end up with.
Yeah, and just bouncing off what you said, like, we saw a similar thing in the West to where Tim Connelly goes to Minnesota. Hey, here's this really big defensive squad that can just put you in the mud. They beat Denver, and then they beat Dallas, and that series did not last very long. So it doesn't have to be that, you know what I mean? But the Knicks are a pretty darn good basketball team, and we will see what the rest of the offseason looks like for them. We briefly touched on the Nets-Rockets trade, talked about what the Nets got in that deal. The Rockets getting a 25 first-round pick swap, their own pick or OKC's pick for Phoenix first. They get a 27 first from Phoenix. They get a 29 first, which is the rights to the more favorable of Dallas or Phoenix, and the rights to swap their own first for the least favorable of that Dallas or Phoenix pick. I was in a headlock when that trade first came through. I feel like we were reeling and reacting to the Mikal Bridges portion. And it's like, oh, hey, the Nets and Rockets did a pick thing. And it felt like there were eight different classifications within that trade. But either way, Nets getting control of their first round over the next 2 years. The Rockets getting some Suns picks. We got some discussion, I guess, from Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN. We talked about the Rockets, maybe not pursuit, but interest in either a Kevin Durant or a Devin Booker if things go sour, and having the Phoenix picks may aid them on their journey to getting there. That feels very much a year or so away if it does get to that point. But I guess any quick thoughts on the Rockets side of things?
Looking to trade futures, huh?
Yeah.
Honestly, my first thing was, because wasn't there a rumor that came out earlier that the Rockets were like, hey, Brooklyn, y'all can have your picks back? And Brooklyn was like, no. Mm-hmm. And now Brooklyn was like, actually.
So you can't have Mikal Bridges, but.
Those picks, we'll take them back. I mean, Houston, the Suns' looming future is kind of something that teams are keeping in their back pocket. So I understand it from the Rockets' perspective. So you just kind of swap out. All right, well, hey, y'all can have some of this back. Give us those, and we'll call it square, you know? The star pursuit thing, it didn't move me. So I'm sorry, but
that I'm sorry.
they have flexibility. So it'll be interesting to see what swing they try and make with those picks.
Okay. And we had another trade come through before the first round of the draft started between the Wizards and the Blazers. The Wizards getting Malcolm Brogdon, the 14th overall pick, which ended up being Bob Carrington, a 29 first, the second most favorable of Washington's own pick, Milwaukee's or Boston's first round pick in 2029, and 2 second round picks. The Blazers getting Denny Avdija in that deal. Steve, what were your initial takeaways from that one?
Oh, I like the, number one, my initial takeaway, salute to all the draft folks and all the cap folks because they provide the information that allows me to have the context to why this is the thing. So if Portland was able to save some money, that makes a whole bunch of sense. Also adding a young talent like Denny with a declining deal makes sense for their timeline. So I think that's where my mind sparked. Honestly, I was thinking, hey, is there another move coming here? Because I was trying to think, okay, Denny works with Portland, but Portland has wings. So where would he exactly slot in? But if you're telling me it's going to be, you know, Denny and Jeremy Grant defensively in the same team, I think that's a fun aspect of it. Malcolm Brogdon being on his fourth team in four seasons is a little odd to me. But if you're Washington, you get an asset, you get some more picks. That's a win for you. Kind of weird to see them go, well, Rui, we have Denny, so it's cool. And then, hey, Denny, we have Bilal, so this is cool. And they're just kind of rolling the dice. But it's clear Washington's trying to kind of carve some more space for Bilal. I don't know if there was any more room for Denny to kind of grow in Washington, despite him having a good year. So you kind of just move forward.
Got you. Like, my first reaction was literally what in all caps? Because I was like, wait, why is Denny being moved? Two, if Denny's being moved, why is he not being moved to like a contending team? Because as we've talked about throughout the history of the show, I'm just like, hey, Denny's a really good connector, a good defender, et cetera. Like, I think he will really pop on a good team. And it's Portland, who is also in a bit of a rebuild slash retool. I was like, well, that's interesting. But beyond that, as more details rolled in, then we got someone from Hoops Hype that tweeted out the tax savings and getting under the apron or getting under the tax for Portland there by moving off of Malcolm Brogdon's money. It's like, okay, well, this is why the Blazers are paying so much to get Denny in. And to your point with Washington, I think they clearly want to give more on-ball usage to Bilal Coulibaly. And we talked about his drives and some of the playmaking from him last year. And so if you are going to lean more in that direction, it makes sense to cash out on Denny, who I believe is very good. I think he's a really good wing defender, good passer. We saw some shooting growth. We saw some scoring aggression growth from him, more importantly, last season. But ultimately, he is a non-star right now. And if you can get 2 first-round picks and kind of reset the clock with one of the rookie sale contracts. Again, you got 14 overall. If you're able to get Malcolm Brogdon, who helps you with your shooting right now, certainly not a traditional table setter, but he at least can take the ball out of like a Jordan Poole's hand sometimes and get him off ball. And or we can just flip Brogdon again for a good team that has postseason usage for him. It makes sense to kind of cash in right now. So it's a deal that made sense for both sides for me. With Portland, I do think he should fit pretty nicely alongside Scoot and Shaedon Sharpe. And I guess Anfernee Simons, I would imagine, no reporting here, but I would imagine we're going to get movement at some point with one of the guards. I feel like science would point to Anfernee Simons on that front, as he's kind of been in trade rooms the last year or so anyway. I would imagine teams that already have interest in him probably perked up and was like, ooh, wait, they had another wing. I don't think they want to bring Shaedon off the bench. They can bring Denny off the bench, but you just traded 2 firsts for him. Like, I don't know if they want to do that. And he's, again, a quality connector. Is this the time to really push those chips to the table and see if we can get Anfernee Simons and really improve our pull-up shooting and things like that? So I'm keeping an eye on Portland on that front, but I do like the Denny fit. The contract is really good and declining somehow. And if you're Washington, 2 firsts, a vet that can be useful now or can be flipped for more stuff as you are trying to retool. It's good stuff. Feels like a good bit of business. So I'm intrigued to see what that looks like. And then just some other NBA transaction news or intentions, I suppose. The Miami Heat and Bam Adebayo expected to agree to a 3-year, $166 million max extension. The Raptors and Scotty Barnes expected to agree to a 5-year max contract worth up to $270 million. The Knicks and OG Anunoby expected to agree to a 5-year, $212.5 million deal, which will include a player option and a trade kicker. And the Nets, we've talked a little bit about them on this podcast so far. The Nets and Nick Claxton expected to agree to a 4-year, $100 million deal. Shams saying that $96 million of that is guaranteed. Any thoughts on either of the four?
Get that money.
There we go.
I mean, Heat, Bam, well-deserved, made sense. Raptors, been building around Scotty Barnes, makes sense. The Knicks, I was like, hey, can they keep OG? And then they kept OG, and it was like, oh. Then I was like, well, Hartenstein. But then OG, and I was like, oh, G. And, you know, bigs are going to get paid. So Nick Claxton, he's done the work. He's a piece for the Nets going forward. So it's a big salute, honestly.
There we go. I guess for me, a little bit of surprise that Bam locked into this max where he could have pushed for an all-NBA spot next year and gotten Supermax eligible. So it just kind of speaks to the level of trust and comfort that he has with and in Miami. Obviously deserving of the money, one of the best defensive players in the league, if not the best defensive player in the league, depending on who you ask. Offensive growth has been there throughout his Miami Heat career. So that's a no-brainer. Scotty Barnes getting the max is a no-brainer. Like, the rookie scale guys that are, you know, your top lottery picks that are good generally just get the max anyway. Scotty legitimately playing at an all-star level before getting hurt. I think it makes sense to lock that in. OG, the Knicks being able to retain him after making that trade is obviously huge. That price tag is high, but cap spike is coming, et cetera. If OG's able to stay healthy, like, I think he's going to provide at least neutral, if not flat out positive value on this deal. He's one of the best defenders in the sport, really good shooter. Can't attack tilted defenses, though you want to see continued growth there, but he's good. Nick Claxton getting paid. Love it. One of the more versatile defenders in the league. Did better dealing with physicality last year. Watching him drive the basketball more, seeing the handle improve is really interesting to me. And again, like, this is very much a retool. I would imagine he gets a little bit more room to explore offensively this year. Not that he's going to be averaging like 10 post-ups a game or anything like that, but they already experimented putting the ball in his hands further out from the basket last year. I would imagine that continues. So get your dollars. 4 for $100 is super reasonable, period. Then you factor in the age, the upside and stuff. I just love that deal. So good bit of work for the Brooklyn Nets as they shift into this next era. Very quickly on the draft front, we did have some trades on first round night, as this is a 2-day affair this year. The Spurs and the Wolves agreeing to a deal. The Spurs getting a 2030 top one protected first round pick from Minnesota and getting an unprotected 2031 first round pick, and the Wolves getting the 8 overall pick, which was Rob Dillingham. I am intrigued by Minnesota cashing in those chips that far out into the future. But getting someone like Dillingham, as explosive as he is, getting Mike Conley for at least a year, if not two, to kind of operate as mentor, says, hey, this is how you run an offense. This is how you do some of the finer things within NBA basketball, I think is cool for Rob. And then again, just having that level of explosiveness coming off the bench, I think is helpful for Minnesota. I think it was Tim Connolly who said after the selection that they expect him to play. This isn't going to just be it's not just going to be sit on the bench and learn from Mike Conley. We're not cashing in these assets for you to sit. So I'm curious to see what the year one experience is going to look like with him. But it's interesting swing. I like it. And if you're the Spurs, like, that's a really interesting bet. If things do go haywire during the Anthony Edwards era further out, we may be coming back to this trade like, oh, that's why they wanted to cash in and trade for those picks. So San Antonio won't get the immediate return there, but we'll be keeping an eye on it. Did you have any thoughts on that one?
Oh, I mean, I think it speaks to, I mean, Minnesota making that move and swinging the fence and adding more money and luxury tax, but getting that kind of talent is a huge deal. And it's a shout out to Dane Moore, who asked Tim Connolly about these kind of moves. Mm-hmm. And Tim Connolly kind of talked about not knowing how they can add this level of talent with how they're trying to keep their guys and how they're trying to figure out the second apron. So I thought it was really intriguing to where Minnesota was like, hey, we have a need at point guard. This is a significant asset, but it's down the line. We're very good right now. We need to add this now. So I think being able to add Dillingham into a ready-made team where he's going to have time to play and operate and grow and then eventually become part of their core, mm-hmm. Very interesting. So I thought that was a really good move for Minnesota. I think for San Antonio, it's like, well, you know, they had drafted your guy, Stephon Castle. So it's like, sure, man, that sounds great.
We'll take that and just quickly bounce off of the Dillingham point, like getting to play on the ready-made team and it being ready-made defensively is super important here, as one of the knocks about Dillingham is just the general size. Like, what does that look like? Well, when you have Rudy Gobert on the roster and Jaden McDaniels on the roster and Nikhil Alexander-Walker on the roster and insert really good defender here, makes it a little bit easier for you to take the swing on hashtag small guard. So love that for him. The context certainly be helpful so some of the offensive things can pop for him. We'll see what the rest of it looks like. The Suns and the Nuggets agreeing to a deal. The Suns got the 28th overall pick, end up being Ryan Dunn, the number 56 overall pick, which we will learn later today what that is, or if it's moved, two future second round picks in 2026 and 2031. The Nuggets trading all that away to move up six slots to get the number 22 overall pick, end up being De'Ron Holmes the second, who draft Twitter certainly likes Mr. Holmes. As I say every year, I'm not a draft Nick, but versatile bigs that can do a little bit of everything on both ends of the floor generally intrigue me. So I'm excited to watch more of him. And I think as we've talked about Denver's backup center situation over the last few years, Mr. Holmes seems like a solid fit for what Denver wants to accomplish. So that's all I have on that front. Also, Ryan Dunn can defend his tail off. We will see what else he provides on the NBA level. I would imagine the Suns kind of looked at their roster and some of the things they wanted to get to last year. Like, you know, it'd be cool if we had like a legit stopper. Can we size up a little bit and take some pressure off of some guys defensively? We will see how much burn Ryan Dunn gets. And again, the shooting, not particularly there with him. We will see what kind of growth and improvement we get there, or if we get some screening usage from him or something. Again, that's going to be another guy that I'm just intrigued to see in summer league if he plays. But those are some of my early thoughts there. Did you have any Suns Nuggets trade thoughts?
No.
All right, fair enough. We move to the next one. The Knicks and the Wizards agreeing to a deal as the Knicks just kept moving the number 26 pick. So first, trade with the Wizards. The Knicks got the 26th overall pick, end up being Dylan Jones. But we have more on that front a little bit later. The 51 overall pick in the draft, excuse me. We'll find that out later today. The Wizards getting the 24th overall pick, end up being Keyshawn George. And then a little bit later, the Knicks and the Thunder agreeing to a deal. Knicks getting 5 second round picks. I am not about to read all of the designations on this second round pick, just on these second round picks. Just know that the Knicks got 5 of those suckers. The Thunder then getting the number 26 overall pick in Dylan Jones. Any thoughts on Knicks Wizards or Knicks Thunder?
So everyone was mad about the Bulls not getting a first rounder for Caruso. And you see the Thunder give the Knicks here, darn.
Yeah, that's, yeah. I ain't gonna hold you. That does kind of add to the, hey man, we couldn't get one of these.
No.
That's kind of tough. That is kind of tough.
Are we going general draft thoughts, by the way?
Yeah, rapid fire on the draft, because again, I am not a draft Nick. I am not about to sit up here and pretend I have 30 minutes of draft analysis for you. I am very excited for summer league and some of the stuff I'm going to watch up until summer league, just kind of prep myself on some stuff. But
that's always the fun part. And c'est la France, frère.
Yeah.
C'est la France, voisin.
Always fun when Steve gets to flex the French.
Just a little bit. I'm rusty. But I think that was part of the fun of it for me. The couple picks that stood out to me, Zach Edey in Memphis feels very fun. Mm-hmm. Screening, size, does the defense translate? Can he now just do his job and also be very large and roll and execute in that Memphis system where they needed a big alongside Jaren Jackson Jr.? That's fun to me. Overall, I kind of like, you know, the chatter about the draft was, hey, it's a weak draft, and I understand that. But it kind of just felt like teams were like, you know what? Let's just swing for it. And so you got to see fits of people that may just fit their system, or they have the potential to grow into something that's even better. I think Dalton falling to the Lakers was fun. That's a ready-made fit. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Tristan Da Silva to the Magic intrigued me. It's like, hey, are you a forward? Do you have size? Can you do multiple things? Welcome to Orlando. So that also intrigued me. I'm trying to say, like, Utah very sneakily getting Isaiah Collier and Cody Williams on the low. Hey, man, that intrigues me. Donovan Klingon being very upset that he fell to 7 and then going to Portland. That intrigued me because what they going to do with them bigs? What are y'all going to have to...
As someone that does not report things, so this is not an official report. Robert Williams, I'm afraid I have some bad news, is what this sounds like to me, because I do not think they are flipping DeAndre Ayton. And they just drafted Klingon. So I would assume that means contender come calling, playoff team come calling. Hey, we need a big. And the Blazers are like, well, that's neat. I need a pick. So that's what, that's what that reads like to me. We will see. Again, we have an entire offseason plus, you know, up to the trade deadline when the new season starts. But if I'm reading tea leaves, like, okay, I guess I'll put it like this. I would be surprised if by the trade deadline, Anfernee Simons and Robert Williams are members of the Portland Trail Blazers. I would be surprised.
Okay. Dylan Jones to OKC stood out to me. And I know I think I got yelled at by some draft Twitter folks. I understand, my fault. But just kind of just in watching some of the tape, it reminded me, I don't want to say it's not apples to apples, Jalen Williams. It's like, hey, you can drive, you can make some reads, got some versatility. That fits what OKC wants. So that popped me. Anything for you, Nikai? So I just wanted to salute this draft. It was just fun. It was fun.
Yeah. I guess just bouncing off of that, like getting Dylan Jones and then also just the most Thunder pick of all time, getting Topic. Like, you're hurt. We don't need you right now. We know you could do a whole lot of stuff, though. So you just take your time. We got the wing room kind of start right now, based on the salary situation over the next couple of years. Like, we may have to move off some people. Be ready in year two, big dog. And so, like, that just super attracts. You mentioned Stephon Castle. I love the Spurs saying, hey. So when Wimby was on the floor, we were an elite defense. When he was not on the floor, we were really bad. Let's try to fix that. Let's get Stephon Castle. That guy's going to compete defensively. Hey, Trey Jones, we appreciate you. I think he's still going to be there. At the very least, we have a bigger guard that we can go to, or we can try to play y'all together sometimes. The spacing might get a little wonky there because as much as I love Stephon Castle, the jumper is not a thing that is ever present in the game right now, at least outside of the arc. So we will see what that looks like long term. But that one was interesting to me. The Pistons going with Ron Holland. I just didn't have that one on the bingo card, especially just kind of listening / reading tea leaves as tried to get prep for the draft and stuff like that. It felt like a lot of noise about Ron Holland sliding. And so for him to go top five, I was like, huh, that's a pleasant surprise. We'll see what that looks like. You already touched on Zach Edey. I'm just intrigued by the Edey experience. Will he be able to move well enough defensively? Because if he is, like, the dude is just massive. He has really good touch. Like, he will just maul folks offensively. Good screener, which I think fits with what Memphis wants to do offensively. Both, you know, flowing in handoffs, just general off-ball screening for Desmond Bane. Pick and roll attack with John Morant when he's back. It's easy to see how he slots in offensively. If the defense holds enough and you have Jaren Jackson Jr. as your front court partner, that should help you on that front. That seems like a pretty solid spot for Zach Edey to land in there. Devin Carter to the Kings. I would imagine putting at least one of Kevin Huerter or Davion Mitchell on notice with that selection. If the scoring pops and literally everything else, he just seems like a hand-in-glove fit. Provides some versatility on both ends for the Kings. Khalil Ware out of Indiana. The Heat going with a big just outside of the lottery. If he shoots, I am intrigued. If he does not shoot, then... quality backup center, at least. Ideally becomes more trustworthy defensively than some of the other backup centers that the Heat have had in recent years. So that seems like a decent pick to me. I think that does it. You hit on Utah already. I talked a little bit about Ryan Dunn. The defense will pop. We will see what the offensive usage is going to look like. I will say, if he's going to be playing alongside Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, Bradley Beal, like that's a lot of spacing. Like, in theory, you can just have him at the 3 or 4 alongside those guys. So we will see. I think that probably does it. I guess just a shout out to Zachary Risacher, going number one overall. We should note the number one pick of the draft. Can shoot, can make reads. Seems like a solid fit. On the wing in Atlanta, we don't know who the guards are going to be in Atlanta by the end of the offseason. It may be Trey and DeJounte. It may just be Trey. It may just be DeJounte. Maybe it's neither. I don't know. So I guess we'll see what it looks like. But the NBA certainly looking for wings all the time. Want guys that can shoot, guys that can attack against tilted defenses, guys that can defend. He projects to be able to do all of those things. Maybe not a number one scoring option, but can fill some gaps. And if he's going to be alongside a star guard creator or two, seems like a nice basketball fit for him.
I respect it.
All right. Other nuggets of news. Kristaps Porzingis having surgery. He's going to be out 5 to 6 months. Talked a little bit about it on the Celtics-Mavs recap. Or wrap up, rather. That kind of spoken about Kristoff's likely going to have surgery this offseason. He is indeed having it, going to be out 5 to 6 months, which takes him to November, maybe December on the 6 month timeline. And with how conservative Boston will likely take it, slash the big man depth that they have, this just feels like Kristaps, make your debut in 2025. We good, big dog. Let's get some young guys some run, et cetera. Do you have any concerns with Kristaps being out for the start of the season, or is Boston proven enough for you where it's going to keep rolling?
No concerns, considering they've shown what they can do with Porzingis in the lineup and what they can do without him in the lineup. So it's an opportunity to kind of maybe grow in different ways and attempt different things. Obviously, they're going to miss him because of the versatility that he adds to the Celtics, but not a real concern as far as their overall playoff picture. I mean, they're the champions for a reason. So I think it's more of a make sure he's right scenario than we need to pivot.
Okay, there we go. Reggie Jackson exercising his $5.25 million player option. So he will be back in Denver at the very least for now. We will see what that second unit looks like and just what the guard slash wing room looks like for Denver, as we are still waiting to see what happens with Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Calvin Booth dropping the we should be OK if we want to have him back, but we should be OK if he does leave. Christian Brown, one of the higher net ratings in the league, along with KCP. So I would project that we'll be fine. Hey man, I'll tell you what, if Christian Brown shoots and becomes an all-defense caliber defender, it should be fine if those two things happen. So we will see if those things happen. And ultimately, we'll see what happens with KCP. Obviously, the offseason has not concluded yet. Shout out to Chris Finch and the Wolves. They agreed to a 4-year contract extension. The Wolves, naturally, again, were in the Western Conference Finals this year for the first time since 2004. So quick salute to Chris Finch. The Pelicans with some front office movement, promoting Swin Cash to senior vice president of basketball operations. Bryson Graham, the new general manager of the Pelicans. Any thoughts on any of the news?
Salute to everyone involved.
There we go. There we go. While we're on the news front, we can now transition to the WNBA side. De'Erica Hamby has been named to the Team USA 3x3 roster to replace Cam Brink, who was out for the year with a torn ACL. Can be having the best season of her career. It seems like a surefire all-star. Will factor into the All-W conversation if her play continues at this level. So quick congratulations to De'Erica Hamby. With Ryan Howard being out right now, they may have to make yet another roster substitution, so we'll keep an eye on that front. But for now, De'Erica Hamby taking the Cam Brink slot. Elizabeth Williams, it was announced earlier this morning that she had surgery to fix a torn meniscus. She will miss the rest of the year. She closed out the year averaging 10.7 rebounds. She was fourth in the W in offensive rebounds per game at 2.8. 1.7 steals, 1.7 blocks. I've said it on the pod a couple of times. If she kept that pace slash stayed healthy, like it's just all defense first team for me, which I don't think I'm going to have a vote this year. We'll see. But she was playing at that level. So it stinks that she got hurt, stinks that she had her season cut short, especially when she was playing at that kind of level. And then one more thing on the injury front, Brittany Sykes with a left foot sprain and Carly Samuelson with a left hand fracture. They are out through the Olympic break. Teams return to play on August 15th. All-Star Games on July the 20th. So from the 20th to the 15th will be your Olympic break there. We will not see either of those two until after the 15th. Samuelson currently averaging career highs in points and assists, shooting a shade under 37% from three on 5.1 attempts. That 5.1 is also a career high. Safe to say the Mystics will miss that shooting. Brittany Sykes has only played 3 games this season after being, continuing to prove that she's one of the best defenders in the league. Grew as a playmaker, drives hit last year as well. So get well soon to everyone involved. On a brighter note, Asia Wilson and Sabrina Ionescu named players of the week earlier this week. Asia, 26.5 points while converting 61% of her twos, 12.5 rebounds, 3 steals, and 2 blocks were averages across 2 games against the Storm and the Sun. Sabrina Ionescu, 3-1 during the stretch, 25 points per game, 55% on twos, 42% from three, made all 12 of her free throws. 9.3 assists, 1.3 steals, also nearly grabbed 5 rebounds per game. So a quick salute to those two. Did you have any Asia or Sabrina thoughts?
Asia's been incredible. And so I think she's the MVP so far. We've seen so much growth, which is insane considering how good she has played and at how high of a level she's played at. But being able to operate off screens, being able to attack and get downhill, it's been really fun to watch. When it comes to Sabrina, I think we've seen the growth as far as having more comfort in playmaking. It's not just the drives. It's the ability to understand, okay, it's drop. Let me go ahead and hesitate. Now I can get downhill, see what the reads are. Oh, you're trapping me. I know I need to drag this out and make a play. So just more versatility, more willingness to take those floaters, more willingness to get in the paint. It's been fun to watch.
There you go. And I think outside of, again, the rookie campaign that was just cut short with injury, like this is just a career high for Sabrina inside the arc in terms of her efficiency. So it's been nice to see that growth from her. Def, Taxes, and Odyssey Sims, you are a Dallas wing, it would appear. Odyssey Sims is back in Dallas on a salary cap hardship contract. The Wings waived Morgan Burch to make that happen. Sims played 22 games with the Wings last year. 2 points, 2 assists in 12 minutes per game. Drives massively important for what Sims brings to the table, and the Wings could use another guard that can get downhill, so Arike doesn't have to carry as much as an offensive burden as she has, especially as she is playing through the Achilles soreness. So shout out to Odyssey Sims being back in Dallas, familiar face in a familiar place. On the Fever, activating Demiris Dantas, waving rookie Celeste Taylor in the process. We will get to see Dantas play soon. One of my favorite role players in the league, honestly. As someone who can really pass the basketball, but also is not afraid to take threes from above the break, not just corner threes. So curious to see how she factors into the big man rotation in Indiana. I obviously hope Celeste is able to find a home soon, as she was one of the more dynamic defenders in college basketball. I think there is a role for that somewhere. And the Dream, waving Crystal Dangerfield and bringing back Maya Caldwell to the roster. So if we're talking about familiar faces and familiar places, we have another example in Atlanta. Did you have any Sims, Dantas, or Caldwell thoughts?
Wings need to have people that they know, understand what they're trying to accomplish, so they need some help. Unfortunate for Celeste Taylor to kind of get bounced, but that's a tough part of the W. Dream trying to figure it out, man.
And a lot to figure out they have. On the Commissioner's Cup front, the Lynx getting a victory over the New York Liberty, 94-89. Nafisa Collier was your MVP with 21-6, along with 3 assists, 3 steals, and a block. Gonna be honest, a little surprised that Fee got it over Bridget Carleton. 23 points, bombed away from 3, 4 rebounds, 5 assists, 3 steals for Bridget Carleton, but had one heck of a game nonetheless. Cecilia Zanda-Lassini with 15 points off the bench. Courtney Williams with 11-8. Alana Smith didn't shoot particularly well, but 6 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists, a steal, and 3 blocks for her. 12 points for Kayla McBride on the Liberty front. 24-11 for Brianna Stewart. 23-10 rebounds for Sabrina Ionescu in the game. 4 assists and 2 steals. Kayla Thornton with 17 points, continuing her 3-point surge. Benaja Laney Hamilton with 13-6 assists in her return. Jonquel Jones, only 3 points, but the Liberty had a time trying to get her to basketball, so that factors into why she only had 3 points in the game. But 12 rebounds, 3 assists, 3 steals, and a block for her. Courtney Vandersloot made her return to the lineup, 4 points, 4 assists, and a steal off the bench. Steve, as this, certainly counts for bragging rights, the bank account's certainly real after the Lynx got the W here, but not a game that counted in the standings. But any takeaways from this one that you're taking with you?
Well, another statement for the Minnesota Lynx, as they are in a tussle with the Connecticut Sun as far as, hey, talk about us, please. We're very good. But the Lynx are very good at basketball. They're a very good basketball team on both ends of the floor. And I thought you saw that displayed in that Commissioner's Cup game. I thought the most interesting part was you probably thought, hey, 3-pointers are really important and they were key in this game. Probably expected it. Kayla McBride and Sabrina Ionescu to kind of shoot the leather off the ball, and they combined to shoot 4 of 20 from 3, while Bridget Carlton and Kayla Thornton combined to shoot 11 of 17 from 3. So you got it from different places. I think what the Lynx did, and it was just back and forth. I love watching the Liberty and the Lynx play. It was just very fun to kind of watch the Liberty try and find the gaps and move the basketball, and the Lynx, their rotations and their activity defensively was very good. And the Liberty kind of responding to, okay, you're not giving us what we want in pick and roll. We'll go to drive and kick. And the Lynx working to take that away. Like, that was just a really fun battle. And you saw in that first half, the ball was moving. I think both teams had really high assist rates because that's what they do. And It was really key. I think the one thing when you look at it, Jonquel Jones is so important to what the Liberty do. The Lynx work to take that away. So in 2 games with the Lynx, I know one doesn't count statistically, but in 2 games, Jonquel Jones has taken 8 shots against the Lynx.
That seems important.
So it was one of those games where they needed Stewie and Jonquel to also help open things up, because if Minnesota can feel comfortable with Fee, Alana Smith, Dorca, and being able to switch against Jonquel, and you can't punish them on that front, it just hurts your overall attack. You don't have some of the play-ending shots that you usually get from them. And I thought Minnesota, as the game progressed, because Sabrina had a really, really good start to this game, but they did a really good job of mixing coverages to where they started out with the squeeze and like, hey, we're just not going to show it all. We'll mix in a drop. We'll throw in two on the ball. We'll mix in a drop to a late switch. And that's where, you know, Alana Smith able to showcase that defensive ability to contain the ball. Everyone could stay at home. They just adjusted throughout the game and made Sabrina uncomfortable, which I think is the next step, being able to handle multiple coverages in a single game. I think she's understood what's going to happen when she knows it's coming. But when you're kind of mixing it, now it gets a little bit tricky. So I think that's where the Liberty, they have to kind of figure those two things out. You can see that's going to be part of their winning formula. It was interesting to watch as Brianna Stewart turned up in the fourth quarter. And it kind of felt like, hey, this might be the deal. And you got a nice reminder that that can happen. But the Lynx had a response every single time. And you kind of have to salute just their overall team flow. They're really hard to guard. They make you sustain defense. The cutting and relocating is really, really good. They always have lineups where everyone can shoot, score, pass, dribble. They have established themselves as a really good team. So I think those are probably my takeaways.
I got you. I think for me, top of the line for me, as basic as it sounds, was this was a basketball game. Like, you see 94-89, especially on the W front, 10-minute quarters, just like, man, where's the defense? This must have been a real shootout, et cetera. And it's like, yes, because the ball went in the basket, but no, because both of these teams worked really hard to try to take things away defensively. And like, for two teams, or two defenses rather, that really do a good job of just mixing things up. Like, we've talked about the Liberty defense, both complimentary and when I've had questions, you know, I raised my hand on that front. But in general, the Liberty are a team that, okay, here's a drop. Here we are at the level. Here's some switching. Here's some pre-switching. Here's some scram switching when we need it. They just do such a good job of dictating to you what type of shots and what kind of opportunities you have offensively. And when there are cracks, oh, we can just problem solve on the fly. We have switchable, smart, versatile defenders that if you do get us, we can just clean up this mess. Like, as we've talked about, you know, going back to last year, that's the beauty of, hey, we don't have to switch with Stewie. We can actually just trap with Stewie. If y'all get that pass off, you're now having to deal with Jonquel at the rim and vice versa. And so for a Lynx team that already moves the ball well, them having to sort through, okay, what exactly is New York trying to throw at us on this possession? What kind of switching are they doing here? Okay, Jonquel's in a drop. What kind of shots can we get here? Oh, y'all are trying to rotate early. What kind of cutting can we get into off the ball? Like, just watching the cat and mouse between both of these teams. And then on the flip side, as you mentioned, the Lynx trying to mix looks up against Sabrina Ionescu, the way that they work to try to take away Jonquel and not even letting her touch the basketball if they can help it. That was just a really fun back and forth and fair. So, like, the scoring totals were high. You saw big buckets from Nafisa Collier. You saw big buckets from Brianna Stewart. You saw Sabrina Ionescu, particularly in that first half. If you did get bad shot that turns a long rebound, or if you got turnover, oh, no, Sabrina's in space. Here's a pull-up. Like, you saw the pockets to where, oh, these teams are talented offensively. We can hit you. But there was just so much work done defensively. And, like, this isn't a one-to-one comparison, but in terms of the way that I, like, consumed that basketball game and thought about it, it reminded me of that Kings-Clippers game from, what, last year or the year before last, where they just set the Nets on fire. And, like, if you didn't watch that game, it probably felt like, well, see, I told you they don't play defense in today's NBA, et cetera, et cetera. But really, it was just, oh, the defense is actually solid. This is just insane shot-making on some of this stuff. I had a similar feel to that in this Lynx-Liberty game, to where these defenses did a lot. They throw in a lot of different looks. You got timely shot making from some unexpected faces, or, you know, particularly if you haven't been watching these teams. Caleb Thornton, she's just been knocking down threes all year long. We will see how long it lasts, because that is a game changer for the Liberty. If Caleb Thornton is just a comfortably good three-point shooter now, and you can't just gap her offensively. But, like, Caleb Thornton continued to knock down shots. Like, Steve, you in particular have been on the, hey, Bridget Carlton's taking all of these shots. There's no real hesitation here. I am open. I am shooting. Oh, this is going to be a soft contest. I am still shooting. And again, like, a little surprised that she didn't get the MVP nod. I know, like, when I got to vote for All-Star Game MVP last year, if you are in person and you get a vote, they typically take up your, like, the voting slip or whatever with, like, 3 or 4 minutes left. in the fourth quarter. And so I would assume that was a similar situation there to where they just took it up way before the game was over with. And so, like, that may be why you saw Fee over Bridget Carlton. Like, either were deserving. It's not, like, a bad selection, to be clear. But I would imagine, like, when the votes were casted played a role into why you didn't see Bridget Carlton get it. But a salute to both of them. I just had a lot of fun with this basketball game.
It was a great game. And a quick fun fact on Bridget Carlton. In the last, I know this doesn't count statistically, the Commissioner's Cup, but in the last six games she's played, she has made four or more threes. In five of them.
That's not easy to do. And then you just think about that within the broader context of the Lynx offense. It's just like, we got to worry about Fee. Kayla McBride is running everywhere. Courtney Williams is knocking down a whole bunch of pull-ups and stuff. Like, your two quote-unquote help points are Alana Smith, who is knocking down threes at a high clip, and Bridget Carlton, who is knocking down threes at a high clip. You don't really get relief against this Lynx offense.
You want to know another fun fact about Bridget Carlton?
Yes.
She's taken 90 field goals on the year. 69 of those are threes.
Nice.
She made a career high 30 threes last year. She's already made 30 threes this year.
Does that include the Commissioner's Cup?
No, I did not include
that one. Okay, so yeah, you include that one. She's already beat last year's total, and she's already like, that's insane. Again, just the makes it also the volume. Like, it's important as you think just basketball is a concept for a defense game planning. Oh, if you hit 100% of your threes, that's cool. Now, if you've only taken two of them, that doesn't really bend us. It doesn't really break us. When you get into the mix of volume and efficiency, that's where you become a threat. That's where you make it more difficult for you to be guarded and as a whole, your offense to be guarded. And so Bridget Carlton taking this step in terms of aggression, very important. Any closing thoughts on the Commissioner's Cup game or just on the Lynx or Liberty at large?
Fun game. Again, I think it's interesting to watch as the Lynx establish themselves. It feels odd because it feels like the Lynx have made a statement against the Aces. The Lynx have made a statement against the Liberty, and then the Lynx meet the Sun and they don't look like the Lynx. And if for the Liberty, it's like, okay, we have the Aces thing that we have to figure out. We feel okay with the Sun, but we don't enjoy it. But this Lynx thing is kind of getting out of control. Like, if I'm these two teams, hey, can we just not see each other in like the second round or anything like that? Like, I would enjoy the series, but man, it'd be tough.
Is it just the mutual head nod as you're on opposite ends of the street?
Yeah.
I see you messing with each other. I am acknowledging your existence. I notice you there. If the playoffs started today, which they do not, we would have Liberty Sky, we would have Sun Dream, we would have Lynx Mercury, and we would have Storm Aces. Storm Aces in the 4-5, to be clear.
Hey, look, let me tell you real quick. This is a tremendous year to get a top two seed. I will leave it at that. You want to be in the 3-6-4-5? None of that sounds fun.
Yeah, that is not cool. Also, just to be respectfully messy, and then we can move on to the mailbag. If the Dream get the Sun in the first round, bro, I don't want to see that. Listen, the Dream offense has already been, and like, again, Ryan is out right now, so it's going to be worse until she gets back because she is just one of the best players in the W. I don't want to see that Sun defense against this Dream offense. We don't need that. We don't need that. The Dream's offense is currently nearly 2 points per 100 possessions worse than the Los Angeles Sparks. They are 2.1 points worse than the Washington Mystics, who have just not had their best players for more than like 8% of the season.
Hey man, you say that the Tina Charles revenge.
Tina's been good.
Hey, when Tina Charles drops 36 in game one, which
then I salute my cap, Tina Charles. This is about the Dream as a concept. I think we talked about them last week. It was like, what's going on here? It's like, well, they don't really have people to bend the defense right now. Like, Alicia can drive. Tina can post you up. Like, who's drawing two right now? And if you are able to shut stuff off with switching, now it's just like, what's the second thing that we're doing? Oh, no. And those are not questions you want to have against the Connecticut Sun defense in particular. to where they could just get funny, but like, actually, Bree Jones, you got to see the show. We are just putting Alyssa Thomas on Alicia Gray. Hey, come drive into me. Let's have fun. Like, if they want to. Naturally, you can just put DeWanna on Alicia Gray, or you want to go Dejanay Carrington, you can. They have all those options if they want to in a playoff setting. I want the Dream to get healthy. And, hey. Yeah, that's a lot of energy for like potential like playoff seeding in June. So we're going to move on to the mailbag. Thank you to those who sent in questions. Dunkerspot@yahoo.com. If you ever have basketball questions, so send them in. We will get to them. First question is coming from the first Daniel that sent in questions today, who says, "Hello, fellas. As somebody who has been a player myself, I do reflect on some of the development and diets in terms of what they are being shown film-wise in season of how young prospects are given. For example, the NBA season allows for about 6 to 8 weeks for athletes who make it to the Final Four or final to prep for the draft and workout stuff. This scheduling seems to also make me think in terms of how to help younger players, as it seems that there is a quick learning curve for these athletes in the W, perhaps even quicker than many other pro leagues in North America. As a coach, how would you go about trying to harp on specific skills for a player to work on? For example, a lead guard who may be very turnover prone because of handle or identifying when to attack gaps, or in comparison, a big who plays primarily drop and learning to not get dented on drives, struggling with angling the body to funnel guards into longer twos or a recovery. What would the reps look like in practice? And how is it maybe taught in situations where you may not have as forgiving of a schedule to get practice reps or on-court visualization? What have you seen or heard from coaches in the league, and how can we learn from them as viewers?"
I think the biggest thing is experience is the best teacher. Playing is the best way to get player development. So I think the W is very much a sprint in that aspect. But if you bring in the NBA aspect, they have that time to get ready for workouts. You go from getting drafted to summer league very quickly, and you have to get acclimated very quickly. So it's not the same, but you know, there are things that happen. So what I would say is the biggest thing, whether it's the W or the NBA, they have to experience it before they can really understand what the differences are. So they have to see it and feel it. And you have to practice reps are fantastic, but it's more showing them what they need to do and what their job is. So understanding, hey, if you're getting two on the ball in pick and roll and you pick up the ball, look at what that does to our team. Look at what position that puts us in. The roller is now taken care of. They can rotate. We don't have a live dribble. They can recover. You have to be able to do this, drag it out, turn the corner, make this part of it. So now you can show that contrast of when you do this, this is what the defense has to do. This is what opens up for us offensively. This is what opens up for you. On the defensive end, it's about doing your job. So being able to teach their fundamental base job, but also understand, okay, when you are in the right position, this is what it looks like. You're there because the guard is funneling it to you. Everyone can stay home. You have to contain that. When you don't contain that pick and roll and you get beat, look at what happens and look at what opens up for their team and look what it does to our defense. So it's about just showing a contrast. You have to be able to show the good, the bad, so that way it can land in their thinking. And the more they have repetitions of the good, the bad, they can understand the difference, they'll start to work towards it, if that makes sense.
There we go. That is really good stuff from Steve. Thank you, sir. As I do not have coaching experience, I don't have much to add on that front. I would just say, like, similar to Steve, giving them the reps is going to accelerate that growth to whatever capacity they can. And I think just kind of broadening the scope, I think it's important as things are just more individualized now. You have your camps and things like that. I just think as a prospect, you need to have a film person in your camp. It doesn't have to be a quote unquote coach specifically, though that'll be helpful. But like having someone in your camp that has insert like synergy account or whatever the case may be, that can actually get you the contrast to speak that Steve is speaking to. Somebody can put two clips together. Like, this is what it looks like when it's good. This one looks like when it ain't. Just having someone that can feed you that stuff, especially on the W side, where, as mentioned in the question, like, you don't get the same like breather before the draft and then heading into like summer league play or whatever. It is tournament. And if you deep in the tournament, it's tournament, draft, the season starts in 2 weeks. Or you got preseason now. So like, if you have someone in your camp already that can kind of supplement you with some, hey, so here's an error, you know, to kind of complement what your trainer may already be doing or what, you know, going to the college ranks, like what the coaching staff is already telling you. If you have someone that can feed you some of the quick stuff, maybe not a full blown edit, you at least have the stuff in your head. And so when you do have that time to work on stuff, you already have like a list of specific things to work on outside of the general stuff that you're doing. So that'd be the one thing that I'd add.
Well, I'll add to it. And then if you watch, just specifically thinking in my mind going to the W, track the progress of the rookies or the younger players, and you can see what's kind of being focused on. Look at Aaliyah Edwards, for example, right? Great in pick and roll. Really good roller. Screen, gets out in that pocket very quick. That stood out right away. What I notated from the start was, boy, those rotations, because the W pre-rotates early, those are getting to her a little bit. Mm-hmm. So is the finishing going to be there? And then the finishing came as she became more comfortable with those rotations or finding the space and finishing. That's interesting. You saw Rekia Jackson, the growth of the drives. It's not they weren't there at the start, but understanding when to attack, how to attack, where to attack. Cam Brink, when she was out there, okay, I'm getting bumped off my spot. Can I get deeper? Can I go quicker? Angel Reese, we talked about on the last pod, but hey, where are the opportunities for me to seal? And can I now go quicker in my move as opposed to trying to power through everything? Caitlin Clark against traps. Like you can note the differences and see kind of where the growth is on both ends. Mm-hmm.
That's good stuff, man. That's good stuff. One's in the chat for Steve. Next question going to come from Kenyon, who says, Seattle and Minnesota are certainly championship contenders this season, but Las Vegas, Connecticut, and New York are definitely championship or bust.
Wait a minute. Did Kenyon disrespect the Mercury? sorry, Kenyon. Continue.
See, respectfully messy.
Yeah.
Hey, don't the Mercury have to win road games to win a championship?
All right.
But anyway, Las Vegas ran back the roster for the most part, and rightfully so. They are the two-time defending champs, after all. New York has just as dynamic of a roster as Las Vegas and, like the Aces, can win in a multitude of ways. They also went toe-to-toe with the Aces in last season's finals. With another year playing together in a balanced roster, this made sense too. For a franchise who has won a playoff series in each of the past seven seasons, yet has not won a championship, Connecticut knows its window is closing fast. Yet, I haven't understood what their plan was to contend with the Aces and Liberty. After Bree Jones' injury last year, they were forced to play small and run the offense and defense through Alyssa Thomas. Her unique skill set allows her to play point forward and guards posts. They needed to double down on the formula and surround her with even more shooters who can defend. Instead, they traded the prototypical 3-and-D wing and Rebecca Allen for the often injured Mariah Jefferson. They signed Rachel Banham, a good shooter, but a liability on defense. And then they re-signed Jones, who is a very good post, but does not complement Thomas's game at all. Before her injury, Stephanie White was running the offense through Jones. Their offense started popping once Thomas was given the reins, and their defense remained consistently stout. Even more perplexing was acquiring Queen Egbo through a trade. She was added to a group of non-shooting posts, Jones, Thomas, and Nelson Adota, which almost guaranteed that the Sun were going to play the majority of their minutes with two non-shooters. Egbo has since been released, which seemed predestined to happen from the start, despite props given to the acquisition from a lot of excited WNBA fans and analysts. I'll raise my hand. After an amazing start to the season by playing an easy schedule, Connecticut finds themselves with a record of 1-3 against New York, Minnesota, Las Vegas, and Seattle. In those four games, they have an offensive rating of 93.1 and a defensive rating of 102. They have an effective field goal percentage of 44.5 and are averaging 4.3 three-pointers made on only 13.5 attempts. Even worse, they are allowing 57.9% shooting from two-point range, worse than the league versus the top five teams in the league, and an effective field goal percentage of 51.9. They can bully Indiana, Dallas, and Chicago and win as many games as they want, but if they can't do it against the best, it won't matter. Is it time to panic if you're a Sun fan? What can they do to salvage their season and compete with the top teams in the league? You guys are the best. Thank you for all you do for fans of the NBA and WNBA. Woo! Well, then.
D-I-S-R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Do you know what that means? What? Well.
Woo! I tell you what. Hey, Kenyon came with some heat. No pun intended.
Well, here's the thing, right? All right, let me see if I can break this down. The top six is very fascinating. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you would say Connecticut is in championship or bust, even though it feels that way, because they're very good and they have to deal with being very good in this era of the Aces being the Aces, the Liberty trying to chase the Aces, and then everybody else trying to chase them. You know what I mean? It's tough. It's hard. This is not easy to do because Las Vegas is very, very good. I think for Connecticut, losing Rebecca Allen really hurt in ways that I don't know if they or people really could understand.
Yeah.
Because of her ability to space the floor, flow right into what they do handoff-wise, and then defend at a high level. And so I think Dejounte Carrington's done a really good job this year as far as filling that gap. Ty Harris done a really good job as far as filling that gap. The problem is you don't have another person that's also off the bench giving you that. You know what I mean? I think I expect Rachel Bannon to play better. I expect the guard play to be stronger, but it is with Connecticut, there is the this is the bit portion of it, where if our guard play is not at a certain level, we're only doing X. I think the Bree Jones point, I mean, she's just coming back from a big injury. So I'm not marking anything in pen with her. I think there's been some really good interior passing from Alyssa Thomas and Bree Jones that has stood out even in these Aces game, the Storm game, to where that's a part of the attack. Dewana Bonner's been very good this year, and that's with the shot not necessarily being at a high level. I mean, she's shooting 28% from three. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to hold. So I think it's for the Sun, it's more maintaining just the wave of this and understanding how they're going to navigate this. And part of that is having to go through these bumps against the good teams, mm-hmm. and understanding, okay, we need to make sure our offense is at this level to be able to compete against them. Because, I mean, even though they lost to Seattle, they held Seattle 72 points. So the defense was still there. They just didn't have the offense there. Aces scored 85. A lot of that was Asia Wilson going A1 on them. But, okay, how do we now balance that out? Can we create shots? I think my only concern with the Sun at this point is the type of shots they can create against the best teams. And it's a little different when you have Bree Jones and you're also still trying to run what you ran last year to a degree, because where's the spacing? Does that give the defense a help point? Can we just slide under? They have to just make the defense pay. So I think that's where I'm kind of at with them. I don't think they're out. Like, I wouldn't call them a fraud. That defense is very good. They're comfortable offensively. They make it really hard on you. This is just part of the season for them, you know? That's kind of where I'm at. What you got, guys?
I guess just to the overall Kenyon question, is it time to worry? Like, I don't feel a heightened need to worry. Like, I think the questions that you have about the Sun against the top tier or, like, with their offense are questions that you have likely had for a minute now with the Sun. And so within that lens, if you were going to be worried about the Sun, like, the time to do that was, like, a year and a half, 2 years ago. And even then, 2 years ago, they made the finals and ultimately just couldn't get it done against these Aces. So if you're going to worry, I guess that just would have came a little bit later. I guess, like, a little, I do think the overall concern is fair to that point. Like, I do think, like, they have to have, like, ideally you have multiple pathways to being able to beat the Aces or beat the Liberty. So them really having pretty much a firm one, we get you in the mud and then muck things up, you know, we win the paint on the other end, feels like their path. And because they are the best or second best defensive team in the league, like, that's a realistic pathway for them. But it is fair to acknowledge, like, that's probably their pathway to beating these teams. And you will want a little bit more optionality on that front. So I do think the concern itself is fair. I will say, just to, I guess, push back a little bit and to be fair to the Sun, and it's noted in the question itself, like, it's not like they didn't try to address things with their roster. Like, I think if Rebecca Allen had a year left on her contract and they just decided we want more guard play and get Mariah Jefferson, I'm kind of with you with, hey, I don't think that's the way to go. Try to get your guard another way. I think this is Beck Allen let them know, hey, or after, you know, re-signing Bree Jones, re-signing Dewana Bonner, I don't think we got the salary to give you. If you're leaving anyway, let's also try to help fix one of these problems on top of that. So I do want to give the Sun a little bit of credit there. Like, it wasn't just, we think it's in our best interest to trade Beck Allen for Mariah Jefferson. I think if all things are equal, I think they would rather have Beck Allen right now. And this is without acknowledging, like, Mariah Jefferson's been hurt, et cetera, because, like, she's had some good flashes this year. But that was more, she's leaving. So let's see if we can get something as she leaves. And to the Bree Jones portion, it's not a perfect fit. I won't go as far to say she doesn't compliment Alyssa Thomas at all. Because Alyssa Thomas has her own, like, ceiling as a scorer, I think having someone like Bree Jones that can just maul folks and unlock the high-low portion of the game, especially since, you know, Dewana Bonner not shooting well right now, I think she will moving forward. But even with DeWanna, like, she's not someone that's consistently drawing two as a scorer. She's just very good. And so having someone, Bree Jones, that can act as a pressure point if there is a size mismatch, or even if there isn't, she's just against another post, someone that can legitimately just win one-on-one inside the arc, I think very much complements all of the handoff and hub things that Alyssa Thomas wants to do. I agree it isn't perfect within the lens of neither of them being true spacers. And that kind of contributes to the overall ceiling that the Sun offense may have against the elite. But there is optionality there. And even going back to what the Sun were last year when Bree Jones was down, they did become more versatile kind of by necessity. But we talked about it on the pod last year. Like, hey, man, DeWanna Bonner's defending Jonquel Jones. I don't know if that's fair to her. Even if that continues to allow AT as a roamer and stuff. I don't know if I want DeWanna defending fives. Like, it's cool that she can and she's willing, but I don't think that's the ideal optimization of her defensively. And so having Bree Jones there to just absorb some context so DeWanna Bonner could be more on the perimeter, so AT can continue to roam and help. Bree Jones is a complementary piece to the core, even if we can all acknowledge that it isn't a perfect fit. So I guess that'd be a little bit of pushback there. I do wonder, like, as the contracts just kind of line up for their core now after last offseason, like, at what point does Connecticut decide to pivot in, like, a major way? Like, I do wonder if after this season, because we got new CBA stuff coming up, everything like that, do we see Bree Jones elsewhere next year? Do they really do try to reorient things around Alyssa and DeWanna? Or do we see an even bigger shift if they aren't able to make a deep run this year? Like, I think that's fair to keep in the back of your head. But I don't know if there's anything they could do now outside of DeWanna returns to form from three, Rachel returns to form from three. You get consistent aggression from Ty Harris. You get consistency, period, from Tiffany Mitchell. Like, if the pieces pop, there's still a pathway for them. So I'm not pushing the big red button on the Sun, but I do think the overall concern is fair.
I will say, I think it's probably imperative they get a top two seed, to me. But, I mean, if you think about it, right now they're at two. Mm-hmm. Their path to get to where they want to go, the Atlanta Dream, and then hypothetically the Minnesota Lynx or the Phoenix Mercury. Mm-hmm. The Sun have made the Phoenix Mercury miserable this season.
Sure.
And right. The one that you said in your question, that was the Minnesota Lynx. So if I'm the Connecticut Sun, do we have some things to address? Yes. But if we can kind of keep it within these parameters, I think we could get to where we want to go. So, you know, mm-hmm. I understand. But also now, the Las Vegas Aces could ruin all that very quickly. So, you know, imagine that you get the Connecticut Sun, get the one seed, and then, hey, the Aces are four. Welcome to the second round.
Oh, no. Like, because based on where standings are right now, and again, we got a whole lot of time left. So mm-hmm. Nothing's set in stone right now. But, like, if the Aces are just in the 4-5 bracket right now, the Dream and the Sky have the same record, and half a game behind them are the Indiana Fever. This could turn into Sun one seed, you get the Fever in the first round, and then maybe the Aces in the second round. Like, that gets like, that's not the most fun path either. So honestly, two might just be the bit for them if they can stay there. But again, plenty of season left, not holding too firm to the current standards right now, but it's just interesting to think through. But thank you, Kenyon, for the very deep question with the research sprinkled in. Got the stats in here. We got article links in the question as well. I appreciate the publicity there. Also, gave the self toot of the horn, like, hey, I'm one of the like 2,700 accounts that Steve follows on Twitter. You are in rare company, and with a detailed question like this, we see why.
I got a wild ratio. My fault.
Nah, you ain't trying to see nonsense. You are very firm and, hey, don't bring that mud in here. So I respect it. See, you don't follow a lot of people. Me, I just block a whole bunch of folks. So it's, you know. we take different paths on the GPS. All right, a few more before we get out of here. This one coming from Roderick, who asked, why does it seem like the Atlanta Dream have no dog in them? I feel like they could be good, but they don't have any fight in them when the going gets tough. Also, what is happening to their offense? I just don't understand it. I have a respectfully messy question I don't think I can get off right now. But I will say, to the dog portion, I don't have much for you. Like, I, as someone that's not in the locker room, and as someone that I'll be in Dream pressers on Zoom here and there, but I'm not there consistently, so I can't speak confidently about the room and the countenance of the people there. So I don't want to be irresponsible with my platform. But as far as the offense portion, without Ryan, who before she went down wasn't shooting well yet on top of that, but without Ryan, like, they don't have anyone that can consistently draw two to the ball. And as they have been intentional about playing slower this year and trying to be more set based, like, they don't have, if you're playing slower and you're being more intentional about running stuff and you don't have someone that draws two, teams are just going to be like, hey, how about we just duck under or switch this stuff with the initial portion of your set? And it feels like a lot of the secondary action is just, okay, well, let's get to the post now. And so it's not the same flow offensively. In addition to, again, they haven't had like an abundance of shooting this year. So I think that's really the biggest part. Like, they're playing slower, the flow isn't the same, and they're also just missing their best or second best player and will be for the foreseeable future. And so the offense just feels even more stagnant than usual.
I think it's an interesting pivot for the Dream. The roster was built to kind of build on what they've built already, but the problem is sometimes when you do that, you can shift too much into one category. Like, I always say the example, you remember when the Celtics made the move and they were like, hey, you know what? Let's go more one-on-one. Let's move away from these sets. And it's like, hey, you guys could still run sets if you'd like.
Yes.
And, so the Dream, it kind of feels like, okay, instead of having the flow and we also have this in plays, it's more we're leaning into this. So it's just a little rougher in the half court for them. And then defensively, they have competitors. I know they do, but there's a lot of times where the ball pressure is just them being back and working to contain. So teams are comfortable running their offense. And I think when you can't crank that pressure back up, that leads to tough moments. So you're not scoring. Your defense isn't built in a way to really bother teams. That combination can put you in a zone where, okay, well, now what do we do? You know, this isn't working to a degree. And that's not, no disrespect, because we've seen them come out hot in these games. But at the same time, how much activity are they showing? You know, are they letting teams just do whatever they want? Now we're not scoring. Teams get easy ones. Now all of a sudden we're down 6 or 8, something like that, you know? Mm-hmm.
All right, well, there we go. There we go. All right, next one's going to come from Warren for end of the program. With stars like Arike, Jewel, Kelsey, Diana Taurasi, and Skylar shooting sub 40% from the field, players like Jackie Young shooting low 40s, and we are 15, 16 games into the season, should there be a cause of concern, or do I trust the stars to get it together?
I can go quick. Trust the stars to get it together.
Okay.
Trust the stars to get together. Like, volume shooters are going to, A, continue to keep that volume up, and they're going to have moments where it doesn't look great. I mean, you look at what Breanna Stewart was shooting, and then all of a sudden that changed very quickly. So they're going to have the attempts. They're going to have the volume to get back in their rhythm. So I wouldn't do too much concern. Kelsey Mitchell didn't have the best starts of the year. It's perked back up. Dwanna Bonner, again, having a great season. Bet you didn't know she was shooting 28% from three. Like, these are things that are going to pick up. Like, Marina Mabry, amazing start, now shooting 39%, probably going to pick back up. Ariel Atkins, these are players that just do this. So I wouldn't be concerned.
Yeah. And even to bounce off of that, like, you mentioned Ariel Atkins, like, Jackie Young was mentioned in the question. Like, some of this is just, I am in a new role. My shots, we may be the same shot volume, but my shots are coming in different ways from different places. I am on the ball a lot more than what was anticipated. Maybe more so in the case of Ariel than like Jackie, because we knew Chelsea wasn't going to be ready for the beginning of the season. And so, like, with that, and then you also mix in with Jackie, like, I think Jackie just has 3 single-digit games. And like, with 2 of those, she was just sick playing. So like, with this low of a sample, that also just dings some of your numbers and some of your efficiency stuff, in addition to the role change and getting different looks. So I am not on the side of like super concerned. And like with Diana Taurasi, like, I've talked about her drives and stuff this year, but overall, she's going to take a lot more threes than she is from inside the arc. And like, generally, if your 3-point rate is going to be 50, 60, 70, 80, your overall field goal percentage is going to be low because a lot of your shots are coming from deep. And like, 38% from three is good. 38% inside the arc is very bad. Like, that's just a difference of shot profile. So I'm not super worried about DT on that front either. And we had similar conversations about this last year. As like, I know Serena in particular didn't get off to a great start shooting the basketball. And by the end of the year, she once again proved, hey, I'm one of the best shooters on the planet. Like, some of the guards getting off to slow scoring starts last year was factored into, you know, we were having early Lexi Brown All-Star conversations last year. which is a testament to how well she was playing, but also Sabrina doesn't really have it going yet. KP doesn't really have it going yet, et cetera, et cetera. So like these slow starts kind of just happen sometimes. And so I'm not super concerned. Like I haven't seen a thing like physically from any of them towards like, ooh, like Jackie can't create the same separation. Like I haven't had that thought. Oh, Skylar just can't get to her spots. Like I haven't had that thought. Ooh, like if there's one person to be alarmed with from the physical, you know, from the physical side, like it's probably Arike, and it's because she's just playing, she's not 100%. And this is in addition to her already just being a high volume shooter slash scorer anyway. So I'm not super concerned long term. Like I think most of them will get that together. Or like if we eventually see Arike miss some time because she just wants to get healthier, like we might see that. But even that's not a long term thing for me. That is, she's clearly hurt. She needs to get healthy. So that's where I land there. Two more and we can get on out of here. This one coming from Tiffany, who says, hi, Nikias and Steve. Love your show and commitment to providing in-depth technical basketball analysis. You are one of the few podcasts that give equal weight and respect to the W. Thank you. Thank you for listening. My question is about Emily Inksler. She has had a lot of ups and downs in the W and some injuries. I was excited to see her breakout performance against Dallas. However, when Aaliyah Edwards returns, she will be back in a lesser role. What are your thoughts on her establishing herself in the league as a vital player? She's a very unique player. It feels like she really has to be in a system where the coach understands her value and she is able to grow.
I think this has probably been and something we've kind of gone back and forth on, more establishing, hey, this can be this. Like, I do think she needs a spot where she can call home to a degree.
Yeah.
Because the talent's always going to get the opportunity, but now is this at least the opportunity to show, okay, there's a consistency behind this. And now you can understand what unlocks Emily Inksler and how you can use that versatility to best shape your team. And so that's kind of been the fun part in Washington, to kind of see the drives pop, the defense pop, the competition pop, and being able to use her in different ways. So it's more of a, hey, this can work. Like you have now a base of, hey, this can work. Like, yeah. We have this. And now teams can kind of see, okay, we could fit this into what we do, as opposed to solely going off the potential or the idea, which I feel like was part of the issue. Not necessarily her fault to a degree, but that's kind of where you grow the game, you showcase what it does, and now hopefully you've established yourself as a certain level in the W.
Yeah. Like I think it's, again, to bounce off of what Steve said and circle back to what we've kind of talked about, it's just really hard to find a home in the W when you're not like a top three pick. And as we've seen with some recent examples, even if you are a top three pick, it ain't easy to kind of find your home and to find your role on that front. And so with Emily, who is, as mentioned in the question, a unique player, 6'1", can do a little bit of everything. You don't know exactly where the jumper lands, but when she has it on, holy crap, this is someone that can play the 3, the 4, sometimes the 5, depending on your lineup, can now spread it. And if you are reacting to her pump fakes, now the drive's really popping. Defensively, she just flies around. Like, I think the defense just translates, period. But finding that offensive translate, of finding the offense or a team that will let her do things with the ball in her hands when she's in lineups to where she may not be the most talented player in the lineup, like that's a tough sell considering how tight the league is overall. And so with Washington, even when Aaliyah comes back, like I do trust, even if it's just her with the second unit, she probably will just have more runway in Washington, if I had to guess. And honestly, that's something that I want to ask Eric Thibault about. But I would imagine she can get more of that on-ball usage with the second unit, and you can give her room, especially this year, as it's fair to say the Mystics are not competing for a championship this year. You can really say, hey, what can she do? And also, just very quickly to the question mentioned, the breakout performance against Dallas, 23 points, 9 rebounds, 3 assists, 2 steals for Emily Inksler. Also helps just over the last 2 games, 6 of 7 from 3. She was 1 of 7 from 3 in the games prior to that one. So that certainly counts as like a 2-game breakout against Dallas. Let's see what it looks like against a team not named Dallas, who's also missing a bunch of folks. But I liked Emily. I talked about her when she was at AU. It's like, hey, she can really do a lot of stuff. Like she very much fits the profile of the type of player I like. Do you have size? Can you handle the ball? Can you drive? Can you defend all over the place? And so I'm always going to root for her. But yeah, we'll see if she's able to build off of that. I think Washington, with their roster contracts and injury situation, there is room for her to really be able to explore. And maybe she does become, if not a long-term option in Washington, at the very least, the other 11 teams are like, oh, okay, she's proven over a 20-game, 25-game sample. Oh, she can just do this. She now factors higher into our free agency plans. And our last one is going to come from a different Daniel who sent us a question a year ago and has now decided to run the question back. It's a short one. 1 year later, both better, Kayla Thornton or Josh Hart?
All long-term storytelling, eh?
I love it.
The tough part here is they both got better, but they also both got better in ways that impact their teams in a really solid way, where Josh Hart just played forever and also made shots and defended a whole bunch of people. And Kayla Thornton is now just making shots at a higher wow. clip while defending a whole lot of people. Yeah. And so I don't know what to do with that. I'm going to go.
It's fun, right?
No, it's not. It's not fun at all. I'm going to go Josh Hart in 7.
Ooh. I feel you. Kayla Thornton, shade under 42% from 3 on 3.3 attempts this year. And that 3-point percentage, easily a career high for her on this kind of volume. And that defense is fun. The cutting is fun.
Don't forget the rebounds.
Also, the rebounds are very timely. Oh, man. I want to rock with Kayla just for, like, the Papa John solidarity. I will also go Josh Hart, though. I think there is a little bit more offensive utility for Josh Hart, especially if he is also making shots. But I do like this question. And, hey, Brent, run this back next year. Let's just make this a dunker spot tradition. We just get Kayla Thornton or Josh Hart every year. Steve, any closing W thoughts before we head out of here?
My closing thought is that's the most Nikias thing ever for that to be the dunker spot tradition. I mean, my gosh, man. What do you want me to do with that?
You know, fair. Fair. That is very much fair. Well, without further ado, as we got W action tipping off in about 45 minutes as of recording, so we will get to see the Dallas Wings in action. So thank you for rocking with us and listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, but Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to JJ Reddy's YouTube channel as we are still dropping content on the channel every Tuesday. That's the day after Monday, the day before Wednesday. So if you would like to check us out, get the visual cues, get some plays spliced in, get to see Steve react to me saying something ridiculous on the pod, or to see me laugh at Steve as he makes references on the pod, and you can check that out. Follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter if you haven't already. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. Friends, if you are trying to tap into the WNBA season, the NBA season is done, basketball is not, come rock with us. Think if you have a W League Pass subscription, you are good to watch games live alongside us now. So if you want that experience, or if you just want to second screen it in general and just kind of chop it up with some hoop heads, come rock with us, come have some fun with this. We're live just about every day, so you will not be missing the Dunker Spot crew for very long. So check that out. The link to the room is in your podcast description, so just click on that. It is free to create a profile, no shenanigans. But with that, we will catch y'all next week.
It's Shonakai. Is somebody gonna match my sleep?